Conrad looked around warily as he entered the hotel dining room. He had a multitude of worries this morning. Pamela and her father were staying at the Holloway house, so they might have come down for breakfast. Likewise, Rebel could be in the dining room. And then there was the matter of Rebel's cousin, Ed, and her brothers, Tom and Bob. From the descriptions Jonas Wade had given him the night before, Conrad knew the Callahan boys were in Ophir, and they were still looking for Frank Morgan. If the Callahans saw Conrad, undoubtedly they would recognize him from the fight at Mimbra's tank. Whether or not they would try to kill him outright, Conrad didn't know. He didn't want to risk it, though. Thankfully, Conrad didn't see any familiar faces in the dining room except for the waiter. By now, the story of how he had wrecked the bathhouse and exposed Rebel would have gone around among the hotel staff, which meant that some of the guests probably had heard it too. A rumor was a pernicious thing, fast on its feet and exceedingly difficult to kill.
Good morning, George. I'll start off with coffee.
Yes, sir, Mr. Browning.
No matter how many embarrassing things happened to him, Conrad Browning had a great deal of money, and no one in Ophir was likely to forget that. Conrad gazed straight ahead while he waited for his coffee. The waiter returned with cup and saucer a few minutes later and placed them in front of Conrad.
Thank you, George. I'll have hot cakes, a slice of ham, and fried eggs.
Yes, sir.
The man's eagerness to please made Conrad feel better. All might not be right with the world, but at least there were signs that eventual normalcy would return.
Well, if it ain't the paper.
Conrad closed his eyes for a second and took a deep breath as he recognized Rebel's voice. Control, he told himself. Calmness and dignity. They would see him through any ordeal.
Good morning, Miss Callahan. Would you care to join me for breakfast?
The invitation clearly took Rebel by surprise.
What?
Conrad motioned elegantly toward the empty chair next to his. He was determined to act as if nothing had happened. If he carried himself in that manner, perhaps other people would then act like nothing had happened, too.
Please join me. You looked lovely this morning.
That was true. As she had in Lordsburg, she wore a dress instead of her usual range garb, a simple light blue gown that clung to the lines of her body. As Rebel hesitated, Conrad pulled out the chair, and after a second...
Well, why the hell not?
George, another cup of coffee, please.
Coming right up, Mr. Browning.
Quite a lovely morning, isn't it, Miss Callahan?
If you say so, Mr. Browning.
Would the young lady like breakfast too, sir?
She would. Bring her the same thing I ordered.
Yes, sir.
That's mighty high-handed of you. How do you know I want to eat with you?
I don't. But I want to eat with you, so I saw no reason not to go ahead and order for you.
You didn't, eh? What are you going to do if Miss Fancy Pants and her daddy come in and see me sitting here with you? Miss Fancy Pants don't like me. Not even a little bit.
I assume your whimsical sobriquet is in reference to Pamela. If she and Mr. Tarleton come in, I intend to ask them to join us as well.
Bravado. That was the key.
Nothing like an early morning gustatorial assemblage to clear the air, eh?
I get it now. You figure nobody can be mad at you if they don't know what the hell you're talking about, right?
I assure you.
No, let me assure you. I ain't forgotten about anything that you did. From kissing me under false pretenses, to lying about that woman you plan on marrying, or to yank down that partition while I didn't have no clothes on. I ain't forgotten, and I sure as hell ain't forgiven.
Really, Rebel, I thought since you agreed to have breakfast with me...
I'm hungry. That's all it amounts to. It don't mean nothing else.
All right. That's a start, at least.
No, it ain't. You and me are still finished.
Conrad wanted to explain to her that he understood that. Whatever had passed between them on the trail was over and done with. He was going to marry Pamela, and his life was going to proceed on the course he had laid out for himself before Rebel Callahan had ever inserted her frequently annoying but equally beguiling presence into his existence.
Rebel, I... Well, I...
But for some reason, those words didn't want to come out of his mouth. He looked at Rebel, and they froze in his throat. If he told her they were through, that bridge was burned. There would be no rebuilding it. And Lord help him, he just wasn't ready to take that step.
You what, comrade?
Before he could say anything, Some instinct made him glance toward the arched entrance between the dining room and the lobby. Clark Tarleton stood there, regarding Conrad with a cool stare. Pamela wasn't with him.
Clark, come join us.
Stick to the plan, such as it was, he told himself. Act like everything is normal. Rather than make a scene, Tarleton came forward slowly into the dining room, but he came grudgingly, with a look of annoyance and embarrassment on his rough-hewn face. He ignored the hand that Conrad thrust out toward him and gave the young man a curt nod instead.
Conrad?
Please, come, sit down and have some breakfast. I feel like I owe you a meal since I had to ask you to forgive me for that missed dinner engagement last night.
I'm sure you didn't feel like dining, especially after everything that happened.
I can explain everything.
I'm sure you can. You've always been a glib young man.
Please, sir, just...
For the moment, Conrad forgot that he and Tarleton were business rivals and regarded the older man simply as a prospective father-in-law. He had to make things right somehow. Tarleton interrupted him again, though.
Miss Callahan, isn't it? You're the young lady I've heard so much about.
I reckon I am.
Tarleton took Rebel's hand.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Miss Callahan. My name is Clark Tarleton.
Oh, Miss Fancy Pants' daddy.
Conrad waited for the explosion, but none came.
I take it you're referring to my daughter Pamela. I should be offended, I suppose, but even a father has to be honest. At times, Pamela's behavior deserves having such a name pinned on her.
Oh.
His graciousness put Rebel off stride, Conrad saw.
I didn't really mean to insult her.
I know that. It's just that the two of you are from vastly different worlds. Pamela has been pampered and spoiled her whole life. She has much more in common with young Browning here.
She can have him. I don't want him.
As for myself, even though I lead a life of relative luxury now, I've done plenty of hard work in my life.
I can tell that.
Once you've lived a hard scrabble existence, you never forget it, no matter how much fortune smiles on you. You always remember the struggle and how you had to be tough to survive.
Damn right. Sounds like you and me think a lot alike, Mr. Tarleton, in spite of our differences.
Call me Clark.
Conrad had to make an effort to keep his jaw from hanging open. The two of them were flirting with each other. That was insane. Tarleton was old enough to be Rebel's father. More than old enough.
Is your wife back east somewhere?
My wife passed away many years ago. I'm a widower.
I'm sorry to hear that.
The pain has pretty much gone away, leaving just the good memories. I will admit, however, that it was a challenge raising Pamela mostly by myself.
Oh, I bet it was.
This was getting more ludicrous by the second. Conrad happened to know that after Pamela's mother had died, Pamela had been raised by a series of governesses, tutors, and household servants. The man was a blatant liar.
How is Pamela feeling this morning? Is she going to come down for breakfast?
Tarleton glared at him, obviously not pleased with the interruption.
She doesn't feel well. She's just going to take coffee in our suite.
Well, I hope she feels better later.
I wouldn't count on it any time soon.
You'll be having breakfast too, Mr. Tarleton?
Yes, of course. That is, if the lady will be.
It's already been ordered.
Well then, bring me my usual, George.
Yes, sir, right away.
Conrad's plan to hold on to his dignity and self-control had worked, he supposed. He wasn't the object of ridicule now. In fact, no one was paying any attention to him at all. And to his great surprise, he found that that was even worse. It was a miserable morning for Conrad. Tarleton had offered to show Rebel around Ophir, and to Conrad's great vexation, she agreed immediately. He supposed they were going to continue this ridiculous flirtation. They were just doing it to spite him, he told himself. Rebel was angry with him over everything that had happened, and Tarleton felt that Conrad had not been properly respectful to Pamela. It wasn't going to work, he vowed. But despite his best intentions, he found himself wandering around Ophir, trailing them at a distance, keeping an eye on them instead of going on about his own business. It was maddening. The two men Brant had sent into the settlement found Conrad around mid-morning and reported that they had loaded on the pack horses all the supplies they had purchased.
From the looks of those clouds over the mountains, there may be a storm brewing. Be careful.
Conrad knew they should have been on their way earlier. Probably they had been sleeping off a night of carousing. However, he couldn't summon up the mental energy to reprimand them.
Yoo-hoo! Mr. Browning!
He turned around to see a woman coming toward him on the boardwalk. She was around 30 years old and had bright red hair and a very erect carriage. Conrad recognized her immediately.
Good morning, Mrs. McShane. It's good to see you again.
Hello, Mr. Browning. I heard you were back in town. Did you have any comment for the Ledger about the railroad line? A tentative date, perhaps, for its arrival?
No, I'm afraid not. Construction is progressing as fast as possible, but it's still too early to say when the railroad will arrive.
Mrs. Allison McShane was the editor and publisher of the Ophir Ledger, the settlement's only newspaper. Her husband, Evan, was the one who had started the paper, bringing his wife and young daughter and son to New Mexico Territory a year earlier, when Ophir was nothing but a raw, wide-open tent city. Evan McShane had gotten the paper started, and then promptly fell ill of a particularly virulent fever and died, leaving his wife and children to make their own way in the world. Everyone in town had expected that Mrs. McShane would take the young'uns and go back to wherever they'd come from, but instead she had decided to keep the newspaper going. As the town had grown and become more respectable, the Ledger had become more successful. Mrs. McShane had a canny business sense and the nose of a bloodhound when it came to tracking down news. Conrad had no doubt that she knew all about the incident at the bathhouse, even though she wouldn't write anything about it in the paper. She had more decorum than that. At least, he hoped so.
Surely you could hazard a guess as to when the big day will be, Mr. Browning?
I'd rather not.
That's fine. Thank you anyway. Oh, I almost forgot.
Was there something else, Mrs. McShane?
Actually, yes, Mr. Browning. I've heard rumors that there have been quite a few problems during construction. Sabotage, Indian attacks, things like that.
Well, obviously I'd prefer to keep that quiet. But I know better than to try to keep secrets from Allison McShane.
You flatter me, Conrad Browning. So, have there been the type of problems I just mentioned?
There have been problems, but steps are being taken to correct them.
What sort of steps?
I brought in my father, who happens to be a notorious gunman with the blood of scores of men on his hands. The thought went through Conrad's mind, but of course there was no way he could say it.
I'd rather not comment on that right now. Discretion, you know.
Of course. But would this have anything to do with a man named Frank Morgan?
Who told you?
Frank Morgan is a famous man, Mr. Browning. I would imagine that it's difficult for him to go anywhere or do anything without word of his actions getting around. What exactly is your connection with him?
He's an old friend of the family. He also owns stock in the New Mexico Rio Grande and Oriental.
So he's an investor?
You could say that.
A drifting gunman owns part of a railroad? A man who some say is a hired killer?
He's used his gun for money, but he's never been a hired killer. He fought only for causes he believed in.
Conrad wasn't sure why he was defending Frank, but the words came out before he could stop them.
So you're saying he's an altruistic gunfighter?
I just think his reputation has been somewhat overblown. I've always found him to be a gentleman.
A gentleman and a scholar?
As a matter of fact, I've never known him to be without a book or two in his saddlebags. He's quite well read.
He sounds like a fascinating man. Will he be coming to Ophir? I'd like to interview him.
He may be here at some time. I don't really know what his plans are.
Well, be sure to introduce him to me if he does come to town. Thank you, Mr. Browning. I'll let you go on about your business now.
Always a pleasure, Mrs. McShane.
Conrad had lunch at a small cafe, and by the time he came back outside, the clouds to the south were thick and dark, and thunder rumbled in the distance. It was raining down there, Conrad thought. But up here in Ophir, the sun was still shining. His mood wasn't very sunny, though. He saw Rebel and Tarleton on the opposite boardwalk, strolling arm in arm.
To hell with them. I've business to conduct, by God.
Conrad spent the afternoon conducting his business. The railroad was going to need a depot when it arrived in Ophir. Conrad had his eye on a piece of land on the southern outskirts of the settlement that he thought would be a perfect location. He spent the afternoon talking to a local attorney who represented the owner of the property. Conrad knew he would have to pay a pretty penny for the land, probably more than it was actually worth, but he believed in getting what he wanted, no matter what the cost. By the end of the day, nothing had been settled, but Conrad felt that genuine progress had been made. He was in a better mood when he returned to the hotel. Pamela Tarleton was waiting for him in the lobby. She was smiling and didn't look upset with him, so perhaps everything was all right after all.
Conrad, darling, I've been looking for you all day.
I'm sorry, Pamela. Your father said you didn't feel well this morning, so I spent the day conducting business. I didn't mean to ignore you.
Don't be silly. I know you have to take care of these things.
Then you're not angry with me?
Not at all.
Not about anything?
Conrad Browning had never learned when to leave well enough alone.
Conrad, I heard about what happened, of course, and I forgive you. I suppose it's only natural that a man would be tempted by such a brazen hussy. Once we're married, I know you'll never stray.
I haven't strayed, and Miss Callahan is not a hussy.
But parading around naked?
She wasn't parading around.
Just as Conrad had done earlier when Allison McShane was asking him about Frank, he found himself defending Rebel without really knowing why.
She was totally innocent, and I was completely to blame for the unfortunate incident. I just hope that someday she can forgive me for the embarrassment I caused her.
Why would you care whether she forgives you or not? She's only a frontier trollop, and she's trying to get her hooks into my father.
So that's it. You're jealous of all the attention your father has paid to Rebel today.
Well, I never would.
Despite what you may think, Miss Callahan is a lady.
Really? Have you heard the way she speaks? Heavens, Conrad, she sounds like an uneducated bumpkin.
Can you ride a horse all day, or throw a lasso, or brand a steer?
What? Of course not. Why would I want to do any of those things?
What would you do if someone took a shot at you? Would you keep your head, or would you scream and collapse in a dead faint?
I don't care for the turn this conversation has taken, Conrad. I think we had better change the subject.
Just don't call Rebel a trollop or any other names. She doesn't deserve them.
My God! Despite everything that's happened, you're still infatuated with her.
What? Don't be ridiculous.
I'm not. I offered to forgive you for your utterly boorish behavior, and yet still you leap to her defense. I think you should just leave me alone, Conrad. Leave me alone. And go somewhere and think about the things you've said and done.
All right, I will.
And when you're ready to come back to me and beg for my forgiveness again, I'll think about it.
You do that, Pamela.
He turned and stalked out of the Holloway house, well aware that some of the people in the lobby had probably witnessed and perhaps overheard part of that scene. More grist for the rumor mill, he told himself. And he realized, with a surge of anger, that he didn't really give a damn either. Without him really thinking about what he was doing, Conrad's steps turned toward the Big Nugget. He wanted a drink. He didn't see Jonas Wade when he came into the saloon, but that was no surprise. It was a little early yet. The saloon keeper was also a gambler, and he would probably have a game going later. Conrad thought that he might sit in on it. He had never been much of a poker player, but he needed something to distract him from the troubles with the railroad and the confused mess that his personal life had become. Getting a beer at the bar, Conrad carried it over to a table and sat down. He nursed the drink for quite a while. There were a few townsmen in the bar, but most of the men wore the rough garb of miners. A dozen or more mines were located in the mountains not far from Ophir, so Conrad wasn't surprised by the miners' presence. Without the business that the miners brought in, this settlement probably wouldn't exist.
Hello, honey. Remember me?
Of course I do. We spoke last night. I don't believe I ever heard your name.
No, I don't reckon you did. It's Abby.
Well then, good evening, Abby. It's good to see you again.
You want another one of those?
You know, I believe I do.
Conrad hadn't had any supper, and he wasn't that used to drinking, but if the first beer had made him feel good, it stood to reason that another one would make him feel even better. Abby went to the bar and was back in just a few minutes with another full mug of beer. As she bent to set it on the table in front of Conrad, one of the miners at the next table suddenly leaned over.
Hey, now, that's one hell of a nice ass you got there, gal.
Abby jerked forward at the unexpected slap, and the mug slipped out of her hand. It hit the table and overturned, dumping all its contents right in Conrad's lap. He scraped his chair back and jumped up, furious and mortified at the same time.
Keep your damn hands to yourself, mister!
Spitfire, eh? Well, come here, Red. I want to take you upstairs. I bet a redhead like you's got freckles all over.
Let go of me, you bastard!
Yeah. You're full of fight, all right. Just the way I like my gals. Ain't nothing more fun than taming one like you.
The lady asked you to let her go.
What the hell? I don't see no lady here. Just a saloon whore.
Let go of her.
The miner looked down at Conrad's beer-soaked trousers.
And why do you reckon I should listen to somebody who can't even keep from pissing all over himself?
That was the last straw. Conrad had long since stopped thinking about what he was doing. It just felt so damned good to be confronting a simple problem directly, with no negotiation, no glib talk, no highfalutin Eastern airs.
I'll piss on you, you son of a bitch!
Conrad had always been rather muscular, and the punch packed enough power so that the miner was thrown backward and lifted completely off his feet. The stunned miner landed on the floor in the middle of the wreckage as his friends jumped back, yelling in anger.
Get that bastard!
Abby stuck a leg out and tripped him before he could reach Conrad. She snatched up a drink tray from another table and swung it over her head, then brought it down on the man's skull with a ringing impact. The man sprawled out, knocked senseless. But there were still several of his companions, bent on handing Conrad a thrashing. As they came at him, he knew he should be scared, but for some reason, he wasn't. He had once heard Frank comment that barbarism was the natural state of mankind. There must have been some truth to that, because he certainly felt barbaric right now. Conrad stepped closer to the man who had thrown it and hooked a punch into the man's midsection. Conrad brought up a sharp left that clicked the man's teeth together and glazed his eyes. His enemies were all around him, so Conrad began to flail wildly at them, knowing that whoever he hit had it coming. He was only vaguely aware of hearing someone shout,
"Hey, it's a boss! And all you Brandon men, come on!"
As more miners threw themselves into the fracas, it quickly went from a small, isolated fight to a full-fledged brawl that threatened to engulf the entire saloon. Conrad was in the middle, swinging punches right and left, absorbing the punishment being dealt out to him. He tasted the salty tang of blood in his mouth and didn't care. When someone bumped into his back, he twisted around and started to throw a punch.
Hey, hold it, Mr. Brown. It's me, Bob Elkins.
Conrad held back his fist. He recognized the man as one of the foremen from the mine his company owned up in the mountains.
Elkins! Is the whole crew here?
Damn near.
How are we doing?
We ain't giving hell to those Tarleton men.
Tarleton?
Yeah, didn't you know? The first fella you laid out was Ned Cameron, the foreman up at Tarleton's mine.
So, this combat was primarily between Browning men and Tarleton men, eh? Conrad liked the sound of that, and he liked the way his employees had jumped into the middle of the fight on his behalf. That was loyalty for you, by God. He wouldn't let them down.
Let's go clean up those bastards!
I'm with you, boss!
They stood back to back, the wealthy young man from Boston who owned the mine, and the brawny miner who toiled there. And their fists wreaked bruising, bloody havoc around them. Eventually, though, someone grabbed Conrad from behind, pinning his arms.
Let me go, damn it, let me go!
Take it easy, boss. We done whipped them all.
Oh, okay.
The saloon looked like a tornado had struck it. Busted up tables and chairs were scattered around the room. The bloodied and battered forms of men lay sprawled in the wreckage, moaning softly in their pain. Half a dozen miners were still on their feet, and although they looked to be on the verge of collapse, they still had the strength to grin at each other triumphantly. Conrad recognized all of them. They were his men, his warriors. Conrad felt a pang of regret as he saw Jonas Wade stepping tentatively through the debris, a devastated look on his face.
My saloon! My beautiful saloon!
Jonas, don't worry. I'll pay for all the damages.
Conrad, you were part of this?
Part of it? He started it! Deck that son of a bitch, Ned Cameron, just as pretty as you please.
Don't blame Mr. Browning, boss. Cameron was being a jackass as usual, and he wouldn't let go of me. That was after he made me drop a full mug of beer on Mr. Browning.
For a moment more, Wade just looked around and shook his head.
It's mighty kind of you to offer to pay for all this.
I insist.
But if you were defending one of my girls, then you're not to blame, even if you threw the first punch. Getting your place busted up is just one of the problems of running a saloon, I reckon.
How about this? Make all of Tarleton's men pony up for their share, and then I'll make up the difference in whatever it takes to put this place back right.
Well, that's still mighty generous of you, but I might just take you up on it. I haven't owned the big nugget for long, and I don't have a lot of operating capital.
Then it's a deal.
Oh, your mouth's bleeding, Mr. Browning. And you really ought to get a wet rag on that eye of yours before it swells up any more. I'd be mighty pleased to take care of you, if you let me.
Sure, Abby. Thanks.
The fight had knocked all of the cobwebs out of Conrad's brain. He was thinking clearly now, for what seemed like the first time in ages. He knew what he had to do. He didn't know where his father was at this moment, but he hoped Frank was having as good a night as he was. Frank reacted before anyone else as more arrows began to fly out of the darkness beyond the reach of the firelight. Even with his hands tied behind his back, his finely honed muscles and reflexes enabled him to surge up from the ground and lunge toward the fire. A couple of bounding steps brought him close, and then, as an arrow whispered past his ear, he threw himself forward in a rolling dive that landed him beside the unconscious Shear and the dead torturer. One of the hard cases pawed at the arrow that had gone through his neck. Another man spun off his feet as an arrow ripped through his thigh. As he sprawled on the ground, he clawed out his revolver and emptied it blindly into the night. Another arrow came out of the darkness, toppling him over backward. By the fire, Frank twisted around and got his hands on the knife that the first man to die had dropped. Working by feet and trying to ignore the chaos around him, he turned the buoy around so that the blade rested against the ropes holding his wrist together. He began to saw desperately on the bomb. One of the ropes suddenly parted, and after a couple of minutes that seemed much longer, the other bonds fell away too. Frank's hands were free. He stuck the buoy knife behind his belt and rapidly flexed his fingers, trying to get full feeling back into them as quickly as he could. The butt of a gun stood up from the dead man's holster. Frank snagged the Colt and slid it into his empty holster. Then he rolled the man off Shear and grabbed the unconscious engineer. He started dragging Shear toward the edge of the cave. Even though it was dangerous, he thought they had a better chance with the Apaches than with the killers working against the railroad. Shear would be terribly mutilated by now if not for the timely interruption. For the second time in recent weeks, Frank is in the unusual position of being thankful for an Indian attack.
Damn it! Morgan's getting away!
A bullet ripped past Frank's head as he straightened with Shear. Letting the unconscious man sag against him and holding him up with his left arm, Frank reached down with his right hand and palmed out the Colt from his holster.
Damn it!
He made the boss owl hoot dive for cover again behind a boulder. While the battle continued behind him, Frank kept moving until he and Shear were at least 50 yards away from the base of the cliff. As Frank watched, He saw that the arrows weren't having much effect now. The hired killers were all crouched behind rocks. Three of them had been killed, but that still left well over a dozen of them, and they were well armed. They could wait out the attack if they chose to.
Let's get out of here!
Giving up good cover was usually a foolish tactic, and a couple of the men paid the price for that rashness, going down as arrows skewered them. The rest of the gang reached for the already saddled horses, though, and leaped onto the animals. With a swift rataplan of hoofbeats, they fled into the night, a couple of arrows winging after them to speed them on their way. That left Frank and Shear on their own, in the dark, with a pack of hostile Apaches practically in their laps. Frank knew Stormy was somewhere close by, along with Wolf. All he had to do was whistle, and the Appaloosa and the Big Cur would make it to his side if they had to charge through hell to do so. But if he called the animals, that would draw attention to him and Shear. He was sure the Apaches had seen the two of them fleeing, but the Indians might not know exactly where they were now. Frank clapped a hand over Shear's mouth.
Take it easy. It's me, Morgan.
Where are we?
Stay quiet. There are Apaches close by.
They stayed where they were beside the tree as Frank listened intently. He didn't hear anything moving in the darkness, but he knew that didn't mean a thing. The Apaches were out there. They waited for at least half an hour before Frank deemed it safe for them to move.
We still need to be quiet and careful. We'll stay away from that fire, just in case any of the Indians are still around. Once we put some distance behind us, I'll whistle up my horse. Maybe yours will come along with them.
Oh, I hope so. I don't know how far I can walk. I hurt like hell.
That's a good thing. At least you're alive to hurt.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Okay, let's go.
Before they could even get started, a handful of dark shapes suddenly loomed around them, appearing so unexpectedly that it was like they had shot up out of the ground.
Do not move, Gringos, or you die.
Frank had known that their chances of getting away were slim. He stood there calmly, not wanting to spook the Indians who surrounded them.
Steady. Don't give them any excuse for killing us.
They don't need an excuse. They're savages.
An explosive grunt came from the Apache who stood right in front of them. It took Frank a second to realize that the man had just laughed.
You are the men who were tied.
Frank knew that many of the Apaches, especially the leaders, spoke three tongues, their own, Spanish, and English.
We were prisoners. The men who held us captive were evil men.
We saw them cut this one. Why should we fight the white men? They kill each other.
We fight them because of what they did to our people, to our women and children.
I know this. And we will continue to fight until all who died are avenged many times over. But our loss would be no less for all that.
We are not your enemies. Your enemies are our enemies. So you are our friends. This man is hurt and needs help.
For a long moment, the leader didn't respond.
Bring him.
The leader of the war party turned and stalked off through the darkness. Frank followed, helping Shear along. The rest of the Apaches continued to surround them. They hadn't disarmed Frank, but clearly they didn't consider him much of a threat. The group plunged into a thick stand of pines, and when they emerged from the other side of it, they found a couple of young men holding the reins of a dozen horses.
I have a horse nearby. Will you let me call him?
Go ahead.
Easy, Wolf. Easy.
This is a horse that belongs to only one man. Mount up.
Your friend can ride with you.
Come on. Can you climb up into the saddle?
I'll try.
Frank used the same stirrup and swung up behind the engineer. He reached around Shear to get hold of the Appaloosa's reins. The Apache leader seemed to know where he was going, even though the night was fairly dark. The route they followed was a twisting one that curved in and out of arroyos, along ridges, and around upthrusts of rock. Frank had no idea how far they were from the railroad construction camp, and he wasn't sure he would be able to find his way back there if he ever got the opportunity. He wondered if he could convince the Apaches to let them go. It seemed unlikely, but the fact that they were still alive gave him reason to hope. It was far into the night before the leader called a halt in a small box canyon with a few trees and a tiny spring at its end. Frank slid down from Stormy's back and then helped Sheer to the ground. Once they were inside, the warriors stacked brush across the narrow opening. With that side closed off and cliffs around the other three sides, they could light a fire here without having to worry about being seen. As a hideout, it was primitive but effective. As the flames of the campfire grew brighter, Frank got his first good look at their captors. All of them had the typical squatty build of the Apaches and wore leggings, breech cloths, and long-sleeved shirts, mostly blue. The leader was a little taller than the others. A band of red cloth held back his thick, graying hair. His face showed the lines of both age and hardship.
I am Mano Rojo, in your gringo tongue, Red Hand. My father rode with Mangas Coloradas and Delgadito. I rode with Loco and Geronimo. Now I lead this band. We are the last Apaches to fight against the white men. We fight because our hearts are heavy with grief, and because our bellies burn with anger. The white men have taken everything from us, except our lives. To take those, many of them must die first. What do you say to this?
I am Frank Morgan. I have heard many stories of the bravery of Mangas Coloradas and Delgadito, of Loco and Geronimo. The Apaches are not my enemies.
Yet you have fought against them.
When I was attacked, I have fought. Never have I sought out the Apaches to do them harm.
Your name is familiar. I have heard it in these mountains, and even below the border in Mexico. You have another name.
Some call me the Drifter.
You have the Red Hand too, Frank Morgan.
I would live in peace, but that is a hard thing to do.
Hard for the Apaches too.
Loco has gone in. So has Geronimo. They live now on reservations, at peace with the white man.
This is what we would have done as well. When word came to us in Mexico that Loco had gone in, we rode north to do the same, bringing our families with us. But before we could travel to the place where the army is and say to the leaders of the whites that we wish to live in peace, we were set upon. Our camp was attacked. Our women and children were killed. Except for a few young men. Our warriors barely escaped with their lives. Some died. It was a mistake for those who attacked us to allow any of us to get away.
This is a bad thing. A tragedy. Do you know who was responsible for it?
White men. Now, all white men must pay.
The wheels of Frank's brain turned over as quickly as those of a racing wagon. He understood a lot more now.
The men who build the railroad through the mountains are my friends. They are not the ones who attacked your camp and killed your loved ones.
How can you know this?
Because I know them. And know that they would not do such a thing. They're interested only in building the railroad. Besides, they are workers, laborers, not gunmen. They would not be able to fight the Apaches and win.
An idea was beginning to form in Frank's head. He had no way of knowing if it was correct, but at least it was a possibility.
My warriors want to kill the two of you. Mostly the young ones feel this way, but some of the older men want to kill you too. You are still alive only because you puzzle me. The other white men, the ones who held you prisoner, seem more evil than you. Why do they hate you?
Because they want to stop the railroad, and we want to stop them.
That wasn't true of Sheer, but Frank was willing to stretch a point. He just hoped that the engineer had sense enough to keep his mouth shut.
They plan to torture my friend and leave him for the white men with the railroad to find, though they would think the Apaches had done this thing. I believe they have done other evil things, and made it to look like you and your men were to blame, Mano Rojo.
This is true?
You have my word on it. Their leader told me as much himself.
Then they want the whites to hate us even more.
That's right. They want you and the men from the railroad to kill each other.
Mano Rojo might not have any formal education other than what he had gotten from the priests at the missions when he was a boy. His Spanish was proof of that. but his brain was quick and cunning anyway.
Such men would not turn away from killing women and children.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
What better way to cause trouble for the railroad than to stir up the Apaches? And what better way to do that than by attacking them while they had their families with them, when they weren't expecting trouble? It all fit. But Frank had no proof of any of it.
I'll make a bargain with you, Monorojo. If you allow my friend and me to leave here in peace, we will tell the leaders of the whites that you and your warriors were going to come in, as Loco and Geronimo did. We will tell them of the evil thing that was done to your people. And this, I swear, I will find the men who did this thing and see to it that they are punished for it. Then you and your men can live in peace.
Monorojo didn't say anything. He just stared at Frank as the seconds dragged by and turned into minutes. At least he was thinking about it, Frank told himself.
We will allow you to leave in peace.
Ah.
But not this one.
What?
Frank held out a hand to stop the engineer from saying or doing anything else. His sudden move had made the other two Apaches finger their knives.
You should let both of us go. My friend needs medical attention.
We will tend to his wound. He will be safe here. And when we know that you have done as you say you will do, Frank Morgan, then he will be freed.
They want to keep me as a hostage? Morgan, you can't let them do that.
I don't reckon I got a whole lot of choice in the matter if they got their heart set on it.
But they're savages. You can't trust them.
I think I can trust Monorojo if he gives me his word.
I give it, as you have given me yours.
Frank took a deep breath. The situation wasn't perfect. Far from it, in fact. But he figured it was the best he could do under the circumstances.
Then we are agreed. As the white men would put it, we got a deal, Monorojo.
Since Conrad had never before taken part in a brawl, such as the one that had erupted in the Big Nugget, he wasn't quite sure what to expect the next morning. What he got were stiff and aching muscles, bruises so sore they made him wince when he touched them gingerly, and a shiner to be proud of. His left eye was ringed with a large circle of black and blue and purple. The swelling around the eye had gone down enough so that he could see better, but it was still puffy. Despite the pain, his head was still clear, and he felt surprisingly good. The more he moved around, the less his muscles hurt, and he realized that he was ravenously hungry. Glancing around the dining room, he didn't see Rebel, Pamela, or Tarleton.
I'm sorry, Mr. Browning. I heard that you were involved in a disturbance. That eye must hurt like the dickens.
It does, Smartamite.
What can I bring you?
A pot of coffee, strong and black. Flapjacks, then a steak and some potatoes.
Yes, sir.
By the way, George.
Yes, sir?
Have you seen Mr. Tarleton or Miss Pamela this morning?
No, sir, I'm afraid not. They haven't come down yet.
What about Miss Rebel Callahan?
No, sir, not her either.
All right. Thank you. Bring that coffee now.
Right away, sir.
Conrad leaned back in his chair and rubbed his jaw as the waiter hurried away. He wasn't sure who he wanted to see first. That was out of his hands, he supposed. He would play the cards as they were dealt. As it turned out, Pamela entered the dining room first, while Conrad was halfway through his first cup of coffee and still waiting for his food. He was sitting where he could keep an eye on the entrance, so he saw Pamela come in. He came to his feet and stood there until he caught her eye. She hesitated, but then walked toward him.
Conrad, darling, you look so battered. I want to give you a big hug, but I'm afraid I might hurt you.
I doubt that you would, but perhaps we'd better not take the chance. Sit down, Pamela. Join me. We have things to talk about.
We do?
That's right.
He held out a hand toward the empty chair on the other side of the table.
Please?
All right.
She waited until he came around the table to hold her chair for her, and then sat down.
You look like a positive ruffian. It's scandalous. I hear that you were attacked in one of those drinking establishments.
The Big Nugget Saloon. But I wasn't exactly attacked. I threw the first punch.
Really? I must say, Conrad, you surprise me. You sound almost proud that you initiated the fisticuffs.
I am. The varmint had it coming, and I let him have a good one.
The varmint?
I could call him some other names, but it wouldn't be polite to use such language in the presence of a lady.
Well, I'm glad to see that you haven't totally lost the qualities of a gentleman. The way you're dressed and your general demeanor had me worried that you were turning into one of these horrid Westerners.
Thank you.
For what?
For comparing me to Western men. It's about time I evoked such a comparison, I think, since many of my business interests are located out here, and I plan to spend much more time west of the Mississippi than I have in the past.
I suppose that's all right for now. But after we're married, surely you plan to spend most of your time in Boston.
That's another thing.
Pamela stared across the table at him, not saying anything, as understanding soaked in on her.
No, you can't possibly... Conrad, you don't mean... I know there have been problems, but you can't just...
I'm sorry, Pamela. I know it's a dastardly thing to do, but I simply don't think it's meant to be. You and I aren't right for each other, and you know it.
I know no such thing. My God, Conrad, we've made so many plans.
You made plans. I just went along with them.
You went along with them, all right. You led me to believe that you wanted this marriage as much as I did.
At the time, that was true. But it's not any longer, and I think it's much better to cause a bit of pain now than a great deal of pain later.
This is because of that little blonde slut, isn't it?
I'll thank you not to talk about Rebel that way.
You fool! Don't you know that she's forgotten you and set her sights on my father now?
She's just trying to make me jealous.
Don't be so quick to laugh it off. She's decided that Clark Tarleton is the better catch, and she's right. My father is a man. You're just a little boy.
I'm sorry I've hurt you, Pamela. As I've indicated, I think this is the best thing in the long run.
She shook her head, glared at him, and probably would have had more to say if her father hadn't entered the dining room at that moment. Clark Tarleton spotted his daughter and Conrad sitting at the table and strode quickly across the room, a scowl on his face.
I hope you're pleased with yourself, Browning. Because of that brawl you and your men started last night, half of my best men are laid up and won't be able to work for several days. Some of them even have broken bones. It'll be weeks before they can go back to work.
While it's true that I threw the first punch, Tarleton, it was your foreman, Ned Cameron, who really caused the fight by acting like a boor. He's the one you should be blaming for any inconvenience, not me.
Well, I do blame you.
Tarleton stopped short as he glanced down at his daughter and saw how ashen and upset she looked.
Pamela! My God, what's wrong?
Conrad has done more than cause trouble for you at the mine, Father. He's just broken our engagement.
What? How dare you?
And do you know why he doesn't want to marry me anymore? It's because of that Callahan woman.
Rebel? Good Lord.
That's not the entire reason. I've been trying to explain to Pamela that she and I just aren't suited to be married to each other. I've decided
That's that- just it! You decided. You didn't ask me. You just made up your mind, and that was it. The engagement was off.
I'm sorry. But yes, that's the way it is. The way it has to be.
You damned insolent pup.
Tarleton brought his fist up and swung it, aiming right at Conrad's head. Ducking under the blow, Conrad stepped in and swiftly got hold of Tarleton's arm. He twisted it and brought it around behind Tarleton's back, forcing the older man to turn.
Clark, don't do this. I'm sure it'll be best for everyone if you...
Let go of me!
Tarleton drove the elbow of his other arm back into Conrad's belly, striking hard with it.
Come along, my dear. This man isn't worth brawling with. You're better off without him.
You're right, Father. He's not good enough to be a member of our family.
Conrad was sorry the situation had deteriorated so badly and turned out in such an embarrassing manner, but at the same time, he was glad to see them go.
Well, that felt rather good. Oh.
As he watched the two of them leave and looked in that direction, Conrad was surprised to see Rebel standing in the dining room entrance. Had she witnessed all of the embarrassing scene with the Tarletons, or just part of it? He was acutely conscious of eyes following him as he walked across the room.
Rebel, I'm glad you're here.
You are? You're glad I got to see you wrestling with a man more than twice your age?
You don't understand. I didn't want to hurt Mr. Tarleton. He was just upset because of the fight in the Big Nugget last night.
I heard about that. Regular saloon tough, ain't ya?
No, not at all. I was just defending a lady.
A saloon girl, the way I heard it.
At any rate, I'm not ashamed of what happened last night. I am, however, sorry that I upset Pamela this morning.
What'd you do?
I told her that our engagement is off. I explained that we weren't suited for each other and that it would be much better for both of us if we did not get married.
You broke it off with her? Just like that?
Swift and merciful.
I wondered why she was crying. Now I reckon I know.
For a moment, Rebel didn't say anything else. She just looked at Conrad and shook her head solemnly and a little bit sadly. It didn't take long for him to grow uncomfortable as she looked at him with a mixture of anger and pity.
Rebel, I thought you would be pleased. I don't understand why...
No, you sure as hell don't.
And with that, she turned and walked away, not looking back at him. Conrad watched her go, flabbergasted by her reaction. Didn't she know that he had ended things with Pamela because he wanted to be with her? Slowly, he went back to his table and sat down. George stood nearby, a tray of food in his hands, a worried look on his face.
Mr. Browning, you still want your breakfast?
I'm sorry, George. I seem to have lost my appetite.
Mano Rojo had given Frank his word that he and Shear would not be harmed. But while Frank believed the chief, he wasn't completely convinced that the rest of the Apaches would live up to the bargain. They were independent cusses, and they had good reason to hate all white men. So Frank had slept lightly that night, counting on his own senses as well as those of Stormy and Wolf to warn him if any of the warriors came creeping close with murder on their minds. He was awake quite a bit, and during those times, he thought about everything that had happened. The more he mulled it over, the more he was convinced that Royal and the rest of the gang of saboteurs were the most likely culprits when it came to the attack that wiped out the families of these Apaches. Royal and the others were working for somebody, though. They were strictly hired guns, and they would have nothing to gain by stopping the spur line other than a payoff. The question was, who would profit if Conrad's venture failed?
Wake up, Shear.
Oh.
The next morning, Frank needed answers, and Walt Shear just might have them.
Who owns the Southwestern and Pacific?
Shear blinked sleepily and then rubbed his eyes. Since he didn't have a shirt, he had begged a blanket from the Apaches. One of the Indians had also given him some sort of foul-smelling medicinal ointment to rub on the long cut on his chest. The wound was caked over with dried blood and medicine, but at least the flesh around it wasn't inflamed. It might heal without infection setting in. Shear would have an ugly scar, but that was a hell of a lot better than being dead.
What? Huh.
I asked, who owns the Southwestern and Pacific?
I don't really know. Some sort of syndicate back east, I believe. The line has offices in Philadelphia and Boston.
You said the SW&P plans to take over the spur line if Conrad Browning fails to get it through.
That's right. It should be quite a lucrative enterprise. The mines around Ophir produce a great deal of ore. There are also successful ranches in the area. The spur line will have plenty of business once it's completed.
So to some people, there's enough at stake to justify murder.
I didn't say that. I don't know anything about murder or sabotage or the attack on those savages.
Would be mighty ironic, though, if Royal and his friends worked for the same fellas you do. It's like that old saying about one hand not knowing what the other hand is doing. They would have tortured you to death without ever knowing that all of you have the same boss.
I suppose it's possible. I don't know anything about it, though.
When they had finished eating a meager breakfast, Mano Rojo brought one of the other Apaches over to Frank.
This is Maldito, the little evil one.
Maldito lived up to his name. He was even shorter and more stockily built than the other warriors. During some battle in the past, he had lost an eye. A white scar slanted across the empty socket where his left eye should have been.
Maldito will take you to where you can find the white man's town.
So he's to be my guide?
That is right.
It looks more like he'd rather skin me alive or stake me out on an anthill.
He understands enough of your tongue to know what you said. He says that he will not dishonor his mouth by using white man's words, but he agrees with you. He would like to kill you, but he will not. Maldito has ridden with me for more than 20 summers. He will do as I have told him.
Frank hoped Mano Rojo was right about that. He wasn't afraid of Maldito, but he would hate to have to kill the ugly little man.
Do you still want to keep me here?
You will stay with us. You will not be mistreated. You have my word on that.
Thank you, Manarojo.
Do not thank me. Your life is truly in the hands of Frank Morgan. If he does not find the men responsible for the attack on our people and see to it that they are punished properly, your life will be forfeited.
Don't let me down, Morgan.
I won't.
Frank got Stormy ready to ride, while Maldito threw a blanket on the back of one of the scrubby ponies the Apaches rode. When they were both mounted, Maldito pointed to the west. This was going to be a mighty quiet trip, since the Apache wouldn't speak English, and Frank knew only a few words of Maldito's language. Maybe it wouldn't take too long to get where they were going. Frank hoped that that proved to be the case. Frank and Maldito had descended into a winding gully and stayed in it for a long time as it snaked across the landscape. When they finally came out, Maldito reined in as they reached the top of a hill. He lifted an arm and pointed. At the bottom of the hill, Frank saw the roadbed that had been graded for the spur line. With it and the sun to orient him, Frank suddenly knew where he was again, and that was a good feeling.
I know you understand most of what I'm saying. Thank you for bringing me out here.
Here, 1 week.
You want to meet me back here in 1 week?
Frank had to make sure he understood correctly. Shear's life might depend on it.
Here, 1 week. Bad men punished, or white men die.
You're saying that I have 1 week to find out who attacked your people, or my friend will be killed?
Maldito smiled, but it didn't make him any less ugly. Frank took the expression as a sign of agreement.
1 week. Bring my friend with you. I'll meet you and tell you the truth.
Maldito took out his knife, ran his thumb along the keen edge, and smiled again. Frank thought he was looking forward to that meeting in a week's time. But was he hoping that Frank would be successful, or that he would have two more white men to kill? Without saying anything else, Maldito turned his pony and rode away. He went back into the gully and disappeared in a matter of moments. With the deadline that Mano Rojo had given him, Frank didn't have time to waste. If he went to Ophir, he might be able to get on the trail of whoever owned the Southwestern and Pacific Railroad.
Stormy, Wolf, let's go to Ophir.